This reading was taken from The Rules of Normal Eating, a common sense approach for dieters, overeaters, undereaters, emotional eaters, and everyone in between. Written by Karen R. Koenig, Chapter 8, Caring for Yourself. You mean do unto myself as I would do unto others? What if you viewed chronic overeating or undereating not as a disorder, sickness, condition, character weakness, tragic flaw, or illness, but as your very best effort to deal with your life? What if eating or denying yourself food has been nothing more than a misguided attempt to take care of yourself? What if you didn't look at disordered eating as your worst problem, but as your best solution to date? There's a psychological principle that maintains that you're always doing the best you can. Even when you're doing poorly, the principle holds true. For example, you might wish to do a better job managing your eating, but given your history and who you are at this point in time, a mediocre or poor job may be the best you can do right now. Saying that you're doing the best you can do in no way implies that you cannot, will not, or should not ever do better. It's neither a condemnation of your present nor a prognosis for your future, neither a criticism nor a judgment of your efforts, abilities, or potential. It's merely a statement, a fact, a description of where you are right now. If you could do better, you would. It's as simple as that. Moreover, if you desire to do better, it's probable that you will, and that's something to be hopeful about. Paradoxically, accepting that you're doing your best right now, and have been all along, is a powerful tool for actually doing better tomorrow. This is a hard concept to wrap your mind around. I know. I'm used to having clients and students challenge me when I tell them that they, or someone else, may not be doing the best they ever can, but they're doing their best right now. I'll understand if you're thinking, of course I could do better. I'm not just trying hard enough. How can this be the best I can do? I refuse to cop out and accept this as my best. What I ask is that instead of challenging this new concept, you try aiming your energy towards understanding that even though your best might not be good enough for you or others, it's the highest level of functioning you're able to achieve at the moment. So, you might be wondering, what does accepting that I'm doing my best have to do with food and taking care of myself? The answer is that moving forward or away from food has somehow turned into a major way you've learned to take care of yourself physically and emotionally. It's neither healthy nor effective, but it's the best approach you've found to date. There are reasons that you use your relationship with food to take care of yourself, and you're fortunate that you have the ability, alone or with help, to reflect back on your childhood and discover them. Remember what you learned yesterday resulted in who you are today. What you learned today will result in who you are tomorrow. Before exploring how and where self-care is learned, it's important to recognize what self-care is. First and foremost, it's a reflection of self-worth. The quality of self-care you practice is predicated on how much you value yourself. In general, if you value something highly, you take good care of it. Conversely, if you don't think too much of something, you probably won't put much effort into taking care of it. This concept is as true for people as it is for material objects. The care you take is directly related to your perception of worth. How did I learn about self-care? Let's say your parents never showed you how to brush your teeth correctly, which they should have, and that you're still doing a pretty sloppy job of it. You might not even realize that you're not brushing long enough, or that you're brushing too hard, or in the wrong direction. You might just breeze along, brushing your teeth as you always have, until someone, perhaps your dentist or hygienist, advises you differently. Similarly, if your parents had an unhealthy relationship with food, they probably unconsciously modeled this dysfunction for you as a child. Even if you weren't abused or neglected in your early years, if your parents turned toward or away from food to cope with their problems, you would believe that these big, powerful, significant people knew exactly what they were doing. why wouldn't you assume that they were right and strive to copy them? The fact is, it was perfectly natural and normal for you to accept what your parents did as appropriate self-care and for you to continue the same behavior without giving it a second thought. Our knowledge about self-care comes to us in the same way as our learning about beliefs. It's not taught as a special subject, but it is subtly woven into the fabric of our young lives. We learn by watching how our parents or caretakers take care of themselves. Monkey see, monkey do. We also learn through the way we are taken care of and through what we are told and taught about good self-care, whether our parents practice it or not. The fact is that our training occurs long before we have any idea we are being schooled. Doesn't self-care mean being self-centered and self-indulgent? Absolutely not. The misconception that taking excellent care of yourself means that you are either selfish or self-indulgent was probably learned in your childhood. Your parents didn't mean to confuse you, but they were probably confused themselves about what healthy caretaking entails. Let's start with a functional family care model and then see where your family may have run into trouble. In healthy family caretaking, each adult takes care of himself or herself and their partner more or less in balance. The family functions on the principle of mutuality. I do not have to hurt myself to take care of your needs, and you do not have to hurt yourself to take care of mine. Your needs and my needs are equally important, and both can be met. This model promotes independence. For example, I'll do what you want this time, and you do what I want next time. Both of our needs are valued and considered. The focus is not on competition or tit for tat, but on the recognition that what goes around comes around, and on overall enhancement of the family unit. Members of a functional family know that everyone benefits when each individual, as well as the family as a whole, all receive high quality care. In a dysfunctional family, the assumption is that in every dyad, mother, father, parent, child, only one person's needs can get met. Instead of a model of mutuality, this is a model of mutual exclusion. On a consistent basis, one or more family members' needs are attended to, while others' needs are ignored or brushed aside. The numerous dysfunctional permutations of this model include: mother neglects herself and puts father's needs first. Mother puts herself first and neglects father's needs. Father puts himself first and neglects mother's needs. Father neglects himself and puts mother's needs first. Mother and father both put their needs first and neglect their children's needs. Father and mother neglect themselves and put their children's needs first. Do any of these models portray the way your family functioned? Take a moment to think about how each of your parents took care of themselves, each other, and you and your siblings, if you had any. Was the model generally mutual or mutually exclusive? Was one of your parents selfish, self-centered, or self-absorbed, focusing more on their own needs and wants than on yours or anyone else's? Were both parents like that? Did you feel that taking care of one or both of them was more important than taking care of yourself? Did they make it seem as if taking care of yourself meant you were selfish? Did they tell you this, or did you just feel it was implied? Did they suggest that taking care of you was a burden for them? Or did one or both of your parents deny their own needs while making sure to take care of everyone else's? Have you adopted a lopsided care model by which you still live today? After decades in this field, I can honestly say that most, if not all, of the disordered eaters I've known or worked with are excellent caretakers of others and poor caretakers of themselves. In fact, caretaker is a term that fits them to a T. Compulsive, emotional eaters often feel wickedly uncomfortable, and sometimes just plain wicked, when they take care of their own needs. Restrictive eaters are used to denying themselves pleasure in and out of the food arena, while giving their all to others. Whichever type of eater you are, and you may alternate between being an overeater and an undereater, my bet is that the caretaking you observed and experienced as a child failed to serve you and reinforce your interests. Remember, if the self-care model in your family was dysfunctional, then the thinking and behavior patterns you learned will be unhealthy as well. Here are some unhealthy, irrational beliefs that you may have learned about taking care of yourself. It's better to take care of others than to take care of myself. Taking care of myself means I'm selfish, self-centered, self-absorbed, self-obsessed, and/or self-indulgent. If I take care of myself, other people will be angry, upset, hurt, or disappointed. I have to choose between taking care of myself and taking care of other people. I don't deserve to take care of myself. It's too late and too hard for me to learn to take care of myself. I should put others' needs before mine because that's what nice people do. If I take care of myself now, I'll pay in spades later. Here are some suggestions for reframing these irrational beliefs. Feel free to improvise and add your own ideas. A chart with two columns follows. The left-hand side of the chart is titled Irrational Belief, and the right-hand side of the chart is titled Rational Beliefs. I am first going to read one item from the left-hand side of the chart, and then I'm going to read an item from the right-hand side of the chart and continue all the way through. So, irrational belief. It's better to take care of others than to take care of myself. Rational belief. I don't have to choose between taking care of myself and taking care of other people. It's healthy for me to take care of myself. I can achieve the best balance by taking care of myself and other people. Taking care of myself means I'm selfish, self-centered, self-absorbed, self-obsessed, and/or self-indulgent. Taking care of myself means I'm healthy. Taking good care of myself means I'm a responsible adult and frees me from the need to be selfish, self-centered, self-absorbed, self-obsessed, or self-indulgent. Only I can determine what it means to take care of myself. If I take care of myself, other people will be angry, upset, hurt, or disappointed. Only in an unhealthy relationship could I anger, upset, or disappoint another person by taking care of myself. I want to choose healthy relationships from now on. I will take care of myself and I expect others to take care of themselves. People who really care about me will want me to take good care of myself. I have to choose between taking care of myself and taking care of other people. I am free to make my own choices about who I want to take care of. I can take care of myself and other people. When I am well taken care of, I feel full enough to give to others. I don't deserve to take good care of myself. I deserve to take good care of myself. I'm the only one who can decide what I do and don't deserve. Everyone deserves to take good care of themselves. It's too late and too hard for me to learn how to take care of myself. Learning to take care of myself may not be as hard as I fear. I've learned to do harder things than take care of myself. It's never too late to learn to take care of myself. Today is the first day of the rest of my life. I should put others' needs before mine because that's what nice people do. Nice people take good care of themselves. Only I can decide what makes me a nice person. I can be nicer to others if I take care of myself. If I take care of myself now, I'll pay in spades later. Life will reward me for taking good care of myself. I choose to take care of myself now and always. No one can ever take away my ability to care for myself. That is the end of the chart. If you had a childhood in which you learned irrational, unhealthy beliefs about taking care of yourself, now is the time to transform them into rational, healthy ones. Until your belief system supports a nourishing, positive view of self-care, it will be exceedingly difficult to overcome your eating problems. You may want to rush into expanding your self-care behaviors, but you'll be stymied if your belief system doesn't support the value of taking care of yourself. Once your beliefs about self-care are healthy and rational, your behavior will be far easier to change. And once you start taking better care of yourself, You won't need to ask unhealthy eating to do it for you. What exactly do you mean by self-care or taking care of myself? The four realms of self-care include physical, mental, psychological, emotional, and spiritual. Naturally, they are deeply intertwined and strongly affect one another with a great deal of overlap. For instance, if you eat mainly junk foods, your body may get run down and serious health problems may ensue, preventing you from getting out and seeing friends or being able to work. Feeling isolated, your spirit might get depressed and you could come to believe that life isn't worth living. This is an extreme but not necessarily uncommon example of the interrelationships among physical, mental, psychological, emotional, and spiritual self-care. Good self-care basically means preventing and repairing damage to oneself. It doesn't mean being good to yourself instead of or at the expense of others. Nor does it mean being self-centered, selfish, self-absorbed, self-indulgent, or obsessed with yourself. It's a fact of life that sometimes when you're taking care of yourself, you end up hurting others. This injury can't be helped and is a natural occurrence in relationships. I cannot emphasize this point strongly enough. Other people may get unintentionally hurt when you are taking really good care of yourself. You didn't mean to hurt them. You meant to not hurt you. No one can get through life without hurting others or being hurt. The best we all can do is try not to deliberately hurt ourselves or others. Not everyone, of course, takes excellent care of themselves in all four self-care realms. Some people are diligent in the physical arena, exercising, getting regular checkups and medical tests, taking vitamins, keeping active, and using preventive measures to stay healthy. Other people may do well with psychological, emotional self-care by working through problems with relationships and communication, reading self-help books, reflecting, attending therapy and transformational workshops, and sharing their feelings with friends. Others may pay special attention to mental care, enriching their minds through reading and classes, traveling extensively, challenging themselves to learn new things, staying curious about the world, and constantly looking for ways to keep mentally alert and alive. Still others may put their energy into expanding and deepening their spiritual self through self-examination, mystical or religious classes, and reading, strengthening their attachments to community or nature, and spending time in the practice of prayer, yoga, meditation, tai chi, or qigong. However, just as it isn't healthy to build up only one set of body muscles and ignore others, it's dangerous in the long run to focus exclusively on only one area of self-care. Yes, taking care of yourself physically or emotionally beats not taking care of yourself at all, but it also leaves you vulnerable in the areas you've neglected. Imagine the bodybuilder or the genius with 3 graduate degrees, all alone with no friends. Or someone so immersed in mystical experience that she ceases taking care of her physical needs. Or the person who spends all his free time reading self-help books and going for therapy, but is constantly sick and never has any fun. What constitutes good physical self-care? Can you tell the difference between someone who really loves her car and someone who couldn't care less about it? Of course you can. The person who's crazy about her car does everything she can to ensure that it will continue to run smoothly. She goes to a reputable mechanic for scheduled maintenance and emergency repairs. She checks her tires monthly and keeps the engine and chassis free from dirt and grime. She follows the instructions in her driver's manual and drives according to the rules of the road. The same goes for a person. Can you spot someone who takes good physical care of himself or herself? I don't mean just outwardly. A slick or perfectly coiffed appearance, expensive clothes and haircut, makeup, cologne, jewelry, accessories, the latest fashions, can mask a lack of genuine self-acceptance. It's like polishing your car to a high gloss while driving around on bald tires. People who take excellent care of themselves physically are not always healthy. but they strive for good health and realize they can do a considerable amount to contribute to it. Good physical self-care includes, but is certainly not limited to, good personal hygiene, keeping yourself generally clean and washed from head to toe, respecting your physical limits and doing physical activities that are age-appropriate, having routine medical and dental checkups, dental hygiene visits, blood tests, and eye exams, scheduling procedures such as a pap smear, colonoscopy, pregnancy test, mammogram, prostate exam, and bone density scan, ordering special tests if certain conditions such as cancer, stroke, diabetes, or heart disease run in your family. Attending follow-up medical visits are as recommended by your doctor and following his or her advice. Getting a second opinion if you have doubts about your diagnosis or treatment. Not suffering with pain and discomfort because you hate doctors, dentists, or hospitals, or are afraid to find out what's wrong. Seeking nutritional counseling if appropriate. Following the directions for taking prescribed and over-the-counter medications and using them in a responsible manner. Eating in a way that decreases your risk of disease. Exercising regularly with a focus on flexibility, endurance, strength, and balance. Taking vitamin and mineral supplements daily as needed. Investigating alternative and integrative medicine as appropriate. Getting a good night's sleep most nights, generally about 8 hours. Taking a nap if it helps you feel rested. Not napping if it keeps you awake at night. Learning how to manage stress effectively. Learning how to manage your emotions effectively. Wearing sunscreen and protective clothing. Wearing clothing that's weather appropriate and using an umbrella in the rain. Not overdoing it with caffeine or alcohol. Avoiding recreational drugs. Never riding in a car in which the driver is alcohol or drug impaired. Slowing down your pace and thinking ahead to avoid accidental injury. Avoiding unnecessary physical risks. Challenging your body with sports and recreational physical activity. Wearing comfortable shoes that don't pose a risk to your balance and safety. Avoiding clothes that are uncomfortable, too tight, or constrict your body's organs or blood flow. Not using tobacco or tobacco products. Staying hydrated by drinking plenty of fluids throughout the day. Staying home from work or leaving work if you're sick. Respecting that your body has its high energy peaks and low energy troughs. If you haven't been taking good physical care of yourself, this list might seem intimidating and overwhelming, but you don't have to follow all the suggestions right this minute. Start small by making one or two appointments or changes. Notice how you feel about taking care of your body. Does it feel a little awkward and strange? Does it feel so unfamiliar that you don't want to continue with good physical care? Bear with the feeling and continue to adhere to healthy practices. Too many people make the mistake of stopping good self-care because it feels unfamiliar and makes them uncomfortable. Discomfort only means that it's a new behavior and will take a little getting used to. What constitutes good mental self-care? Although it's impossible and totally unnatural to try to separate mind from body, an industrialized world tendency, when I speak of mental self-care, I'm talking about your intellectual and cognitive capacities. If you don't keep your mind active, it will become sluggish and stagnant. As the old adage says, use it or lose it. Keeping your brain in gear has proven to be a preventative measure against Alzheimer's disease and general cognitive decline, and it also works prophylactically to ward off lack of confidence and self-worth. I'm not suggesting that you become a know-it-all or permanent student simply to enhance your sense of self. I am suggesting that challenging your brain and staying intellectually engaged with and curious about the world will contribute significantly to your well-being. Keeping your brain busy with learning also makes you a more interesting person, both to yourself and others. People want to be around others who can converse intelligently on a range of subjects. Because good self-care also includes having a strong social network, staying active mentally will increase the likelihood that people will want to be part of yours. Good mental health care includes, but is certainly not limited to, keeping abreast of what's going on in your community, country, and the world, being able to make cogent, rational, intellectual arguments for the principles and ideas you believe in deeply, being able to back up and give evidence for your opinions, finding new learning opportunities through travel, books, videos, lectures, classes, workshops, and so forth, refraining from total reliance on tools such as calculators to do mathematical figuring, becoming a true master in one or two areas of knowledge or expertise, regularly testing your memory and keeping it sharp, learning new skills, hobbies, sports, and activities, staying open to unfamiliar ideas and ways of thinking, especially those that challenge your current views, using your imagination as frequently as possible, listening well when someone really knows what they are talking about, making it your business to learn about as many things as you can. A word here about following the news. I hear many people say that they don't want to know what's going on in the world because the news is generally such a bummer. We may all feel that way at times, especially after September 11th, 2001. There is such a thing as news overkill, and there is no question that the media sometimes shows little interest in the sensitivities of its watchers, listeners, and readers. It's all too easy to become overwhelmed by a constant diet of disaster and tragedy. However, good psychological, emotional self-care includes being able to tolerate the helplessness that the news often generates, as well as finding ways to take action to counteract this feeling. I'm not suggesting that you turn yourself into a news junkie. I'm saying that good self-care does not include chronically sticking your head in the sand because what you hear upsets you. People who feel empowered find ways to change a situation and keep from feeling helpless. Recall Reinhold Niebuhr's Serenity Prayer. Learn to accept the things you cannot change and, whenever possible, take action, locally or globally, to change the things you can and make the world a better place. Nothing builds self-esteem like feeling truly empowered. What constitutes good psychological, emotional self-care? While the study of psychological or emotional health is not an exact science, we can make certain generalizations about it. First, people who truly value themselves take good emotional care of themselves. Remember the car analogy? To understand what constitutes good emotional self-care, we have to understand what psychological or emotional health is. And to do that, it might help to look at what it definitely is not. Psychological or emotional health is not being happy, positive, confident, and upbeat all the time. Always feeling on top of things. Being in complete control of your life. Being independent and never depending on others. Having all the answers. Being liked by everyone. Thinking you are or trying to be perfect. Feeling good only about yourself or other people. Being strong all the time. Looking always outward and never inward. Take a minute to think about what constitutes psychological, emotional health. Would you include any of the above? Let's look at a different way of thinking. Good psychological, emotional health includes the following: ability to tolerate and experience all your feelings, even when they are intense and make you highly uncomfortable. Ability to tolerate ambivalence and see more gray than black and white. Willingness to look equally comfortably at your strengths and weaknesses. Self-reflection. Good balance of work and play. Placing an equal value on independence and dependence. Feeling generally positive and trusting of the world around you. Valuing and craving genuine intimacy and also feeling comfortable with solitude. Seeing both yourself and others as emotional resources. engaging in flexible, non-rigid thinking most of the time, valuing people over maternal things, sorry, valuing people over material things, asserting your needs and also respecting and valuing the needs of others, being open to new ways of thinking and doing, but also maintaining strong convictions, finding meaning in living and being alive, looking for and finding people who treat you well, being able to laugh at yourself, especially at your mistakes, developing outlets for your creative abilities, being comfortable standing up for yourself when you are right and admitting when you are wrong, making mostly rational decisions that enhance your well-being, having the courage to take risks when they are to your long-term advantage and to refrain from risks when they are not, being willing to deal with your past, including childhood or adult trauma, expressing your needs directly, expecting that being an adult means you will not always be loved unconditionally, being accountable and taking responsibility for yourself, accepting that you are doing the best you can, even as you try to do better. The above list is not meant to be exhaustive, but it offers a window into qualities you can strive for to become more psychologically, emotionally sound. Please note that because you are human, it is impossible to achieve or excel at every criterion. Psychological emotional health requires practice. None of us is in perfect psychological emotional health because we're all recovering from childhood wounds of one kind or another. We are all perfectly imperfect. It's important, too, to take into consideration how cultural values affect psychological emotional health. For instance, Western societies may value independence over teamwork. Eastern ones may attach great importance to manners and saving face. Although it's necessary to be sensitive to cultural values, it's equally necessary to recognize these occasions when archaic values get in the way of psychological emotional health. One of the hallmarks of good psychological and emotional self-care is having a strong, unquestioned loyalty toward it. This means having an unequivocal desire to be good to yourself that isn't riddled with unconscious, conflicting feelings and doubts about whether you are worth it or not. Either you are or you aren't. Forget gray. Here's one area where black and white thinking is not only acceptable, but imperative. Your decision about whether or not you're worth taking care of to the best of your ability rests at the heart of self-care. And not surprisingly, it will either move you toward becoming a normal leader or be a barrier to it. If you're uncertain about your deservedness and self-worth, you will surely sabotage your attempts at normal eating. So before throwing yourself into increased self-care efforts, take all the time you need to resolve this dilemma. Intrapsychic conflict impedes growth, change, and recovery, and makes them more of a struggle. So make sure that you feel certain you deserve to be good to you. If you meet many or most of the criteria for good psychological, emotional self-care, you're probably feeling pretty good about yourself in general. Continue to remain aware of what you're doing and thinking. Be scrupulously honest with yourself, even when it hurts, and be willing to go into unfamiliar territory and to change when your behavior or thinking isn't working for you. Whenever you find yourself being rigid, you're losing ground. Good emotional and psychological health requires flexible reflection and action. What constitutes good spiritual self-care? In today's material world, spirituality is often sadly neglected. Eagerness for doing has eclipsed interest in simply being, because when we try to listen to the still, small voice inside, we're often visited by disquieting feelings and unsettling questions. If we can't answer them right away, or if we feel pressure to come up with the right answer, we get scared and overwhelmed. So, rather than spending time in contemplation, we rush away from our confusion and uncertainty into the safety of known and familiar activities. Spirituality has also become associated with organized religion and belief in God. Many people have given up on their spiritual selves because they were forced to worship at a church, synagogue, or mosque as a child, or to attend a religious school that squelched their individualism, critical thinking skills, and uniqueness. Other people neglect their spiritual side because they believe that it's not crucial to their happiness or success, or they simply feel they don't have time for it. But spirituality is an internal feeling, and you don't have to step inside a house of worship or believe in a supreme being to feel or nurture it. Spirituality has to do with feeling connected to something larger than yourself and believing there is a purpose to your life beyond meeting your personal needs. It has to do with revering the world and striving to make it a better place. Atheists and agnostics can be as spiritual as nuns, priests, rabbis, and ministers. Spirituality is the paradoxical ability to recognize your insignificance in the world, as well as your grandness, your universality, as well as your uniqueness, the fact that you and everything else in the world are sacred and special. Good spiritual self-care includes, but is certainly not limited to, feeling connected to the earth, nature, and the humanity of everyone on the planet. Having a sense of something larger than yourself, whether it is God or a higher power, or a community or purpose that lends meaning to your existence. Looking for ways to feel the awesomeness of yourself, others, and the world. Finding ways to give your unique gifts to the world. Looking for opportunities to connect more profoundly to yourself, others, and the world around you. Acting in a moral, ethical, and rational ways. Finding ways to deeply appreciate and honor people, places, and things. Making emotional peace with illness, death, and the terrible things that happen on the planet, which means accepting and not denying that anything can happen to anyone at any time. Coming to terms with your own mortality and the mortality of those you love. Being open to new ways of looking at yourself in connection to the universe. One last word about spiritual self-care. Many people are not able to examine this part of their life until they've achieved a modicum of physical, mental, and psychological emotional health. Imagine trying to discuss good and evil with a starving person. A good meal is needed to free them to think about other things. As Alcoholics Anonymous says, first things first. It's natural to try to build a comfortable physical, mental, and emotional foundation before embarking on less tangible endeavors. However, this is not a must. In fact, for many people, achieving spiritual centeredness is a precursor to physical, mental, and emotional soundness. If there is no meaning to life, why bother striving for any kind of health? People seek spirituality in many ways, so feel free to explore what works for you. Will taking better care of myself help me become a normal eater? I hope by now you accept that you've been doing your best to cope and take care of yourself, even if you've been doing it by undereating or overeating. I hope you can also see that disordered eating has now become a problem in its own right. Not only does it not work for you, it works against you. Taking better care of yourself is what's called a twofer. The price of one action buys you two great results. It will help you make enormous strides in becoming a normal eater, and it will provide you with the skills you need to live a more satisfying, enjoyable, healthy, successful life. The two go hand in hand. Once you stop repeatedly misinterpreting your self-care signals, mixing apples and oranges, pardon the pun, you'll stop confusing hunger with your emotional needs and start responding to each more appropriately. You'll end up turning to food abuses less often and to whatever rings your emotional chimes more often. In fact, it isn't possible to have a serious restrictive eating problem or a severe compulsive emotional eating problem and be taking good care of yourself physically and emotionally. If you're physically hungry and refuse yourself food, or if you're full and you keep eating, you're not taking care of your body. And if you're eating or restricting food instead of feeling your feelings, you're not taking care of yourself emotionally. These chronic patterns of disordered eating are antithetical to good self-care. An exception in which good self-care means restriction is when your diet is constrained by a digestive disorder or bona fide food allergy. If you can view these constraints as non-deprivational, rational, healthy choices that you are making to maintain good health, there's no reason for them to impair your ability to lead a happy, productive life. And remember, self-care does not mean never using food to lift your spirits. The major difference between normal and disordered eaters is the frequency with which they use food or food issues to take care of themselves and their reaction when they do. Normal eaters may occasionally take care of themselves by eating or non-eating. They may skip a meal, make impulsive food choices, or overeat once in a while. They may be too busy to eat or ignore the rumblings in their stomach to comfort their child, clean the house before company arrives, meet with a client, or get to a movie on time. They may occasionally grab a candy bar at the checkout counter, delight in a slice of hot apple pie, or leave the table stuffed with holiday turkey. They find food tasty and delicious, and sometimes it makes them feel better, but they don't depend on eating or not eating to take care of them. Think of the relationship between self-care and disordered eating like this. Whenever you eat or restrict food based on your emotions, you are preventing yourself from meeting an underlying emotional or physical need. You're ignoring and distracting yourself from a yearning inside that desires to be met in non-food related ways. These needs will not simply go away, nor should they, because they represent an authentic, valuable, healthy part of you that needs to be attended to. Therefore, they must be addressed. Here are some food-related examples that show how to honor yourself. By resisting the urge to weigh yourself when you're anxious and instead sitting with your feelings, you are building emotional muscle. When you take it slow, but choose to finish the food on your plate because you're still hungry, you're responding to your body's need for fuel. When you pull your mind away from ruminating and overeating the previous night, you're disciplining yourself to live in the present. When you choose a dish of ice cream over a carrot without calculating the calories you're consuming, you are practicing giving yourself permission to experience pleasure. When you order a souffle rather than your usual garden salad and eat without guilt, you're making a public statement about your right to enjoy food. When you get home from work and hop on the treadmill for 30 minutes instead of gobbling down a bag of jelly beans, you are de-stressing your body. When you drag yourself off to bed instead of polishing off the mooshu shrimp you had for dinner, you are respecting your need for sleep. When you call a friend, go to a movie, write a letter to a family member, or take a walk instead of diving into the cookie jar when you're feeling blue, you're reminding yourself that you have the power to take care of your emotional needs. When you express your disappointment at someone who hurt you, rather than skip your lunch with her, you are asserting that you have the right to honor your feelings. Even as you begin to take better care of yourself and address your underlying emotional needs, your life will not get better instantly. Not eating emotionally, compulsively, or restrictively is only the first step. Doing what needs to be done to address your emotional needs is the second, or you can reverse the order and start to address your emotional needs first, which will help you move toward normal eating. Both efforts are essential part of good self-care, and the more you do one, the easier it will be to do the other. If I believe I am a deserving person, will I take better care of myself? Although many aspects of disordered eating are unconscious, both restrictive and compulsive emotional eaters sometimes make conscious food decisions that are irrational. Nowhere is this kind of dysfunctional decision making more prevalent than around the issue of deservedness. Disordered eaters often suffer great confusion and doubt about whether they deserve to feel pleasure, and as a result, they end up either denying themselves the foods they crave or overeating them. For example, after a stressful day at work, do you as a compulsive eater return home exhausted and zoom toward the kitchen? You might remind yourself, I know I probably shouldn't have a cookie, but I deserve a little treat to make up for my crummy day. Do you feel somewhat irritated, defensive, and self-righteous when you make this statement? Your actions say that you believe you merit compensation because you're stressed, and that compensation should be in the form of food. The motivation to feel better is admirable, but the belief about deservedness is twisted. Here's how. There is absolutely no question that you are a deserving, worthwhile person. You are, I am, we all are. But when you base eating decisions on what you deserve, you're missing the point. Yes, you deserve that cookie, cake, candy, etc. You deserve seconds, fifths, everything on the menu or in the bakery. If you defend your eating by saying that you deserve something to eat, you will never say no to food because you will always be deserving. Get it? The question isn't, are you deserving, but are you hungry? The fact that you have to prove you are deserving is a dead giveaway that you don't really believe it. Someone who feels truly deserving and is unconflicted about her self-worth won't think much about being deserving. It's a given. Telling yourself that you deserve to eat or buy that pretty silk shirt you don't need or have your nails done at a place you can't afford is merely a way of reassuring yourself. If you were absolutely certain you were a deserving person, why would you have to keep proving it over and over again with food or anything else? Restrictive eaters also have many doubts about being deserving. Perhaps you're prone to feeling that you're not entitled to the food in your refrigerator, or to eating out at a restaurant, splurging on a fine meal to celebrate a special occasion, enjoying some of your old favorites at a family get-together, eating in front of others, or even pleasuring yourself with food. Unlike the compulsive eater who eats to prove that she is deserving, you don't eat as proof that you aren't. Consistently saying no to food as a way of reinforcing your negative thinking about yourself and denying that you are a worthy person. Eating and enjoying food is a way to nurture your feelings of self-worth until you feel genuinely deserving. Neither attitude toward food demonstrates the truth. You are a valuable, deserving person, whether you eat or not. Listen to yourself carefully to hear if you have a deservedness dilemma that gets played out in the food arena. Watch out for the phrases, I shouldn't, but I deserve, and I should, but I don't deserve. They're both telltale indications that you are conflicted about your self-worth. If you're a compulsive eater, tell yourself that of course you deserve whatever it is you want to eat, but that the issue is hunger. The issue is craving. If you're a restrictive eater and want food, tell yourself that eating would be a good choice because you respect and honor your body's messages. Keep reminding yourself that if you deserve anything, it's to be healthy and feel safe and comfortable around food. Disconnecting food from the issue of whether or not you deserve it, frees you to focus on hunger, making satisfying choices, eating with awareness and enjoyment, and stopping when you're full or satisfied. Here's one area in which you can comfortably use the word always. You are always deserving. Work on keeping your feeling that you are deserving stable, while allow your feelings about food to fluctuate according to your bodily wants and needs. This completes this chapter of reading. Feel free to review materials as needed. Thank you for listening.